Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ideally, you leave as little footprint as possible when you're telling a true crime story. Your job is to gather the facts of a case and arrange them as vividly as possible. Somebody else has already done all the dirty work for you. Arm yourself with some steady work habits and a well-lit workspace, and there's really nothing to it, just the simple pleasures of research, footwork, and presentation. It's like being a florist. You ask a few questions about the occasion you're being asked to mark, and then you hide your own signature somewhere in the arrangement.
That's John Darnielle reading an excerpt from his novel, Devil House. It's the story of a true crime writer named Gage Chandler, who's working on a new book. Gage actually moves into the house where the grisly murders that he's writing about happened. It's John's third novel. His debut, Wolf in White Van, was a nominee for the National Book Award for Fiction. When John is not writing novels, he's writing and performing songs for the Mountain Goats. Rolling Stone has described him as the best storyteller in rock. John's fans once launched a petition to name him the United States Poet Laureate. I would have voted for him. John joined us from his home in Durham, North Carolina, to talk about Devil House.
I don't really mark the moment of what makes me want to write something, except that I did hear about this thing called Castle Doctrine that's used a lot by gun groups to justify shooting people who, but very interested in the name Castle Doctrine, right? So I looked into it and I thought about castles. I thought a lot about castles. And I said, well, if I was going to write a book, maybe I'll have a guy who's supposed to be descended from kings. What could happen there? So I had some crime ideas in my head. And I had some castle ideas in my head. And then I just started going.
And I've read that there was you live in Durham, North Carolina, and that there was this building with this homemade sign that kind of intrigued you.
That's right. That's a big part of it. It was called Monster Triple X. It was a brick building that's gone now across the street from Golden Belt, which is a former hosiery mill that had been converted to offices and now is converted to condos like everything else around here. We got thrown out. I did, and the really wonderful organization down the hall from me, Youth Build, we got told that they were going to retrofit the building for condominiums. So we had to leave, and this was sort of a later version of what had happened to the building across the street, which was a strip of brick buildings that had been there since probably the late 1800s. But they were in a state of decay, and one of them at one point for like a week, I happened to drive past it, and there was a hand-painted sign out front that said Monster Triple X DVDs, and it looked so homemade, it looked like something from a different universe, and I sort of bonded about it with Christina at Merge, the publicist at Merge was like, oh, did you see Monster Triple X? Everything these days is laser printed, but this was hand painted, and it was sort of darkly inspiring in that way. And then it was gone. I saw it once.
Mm-hmm. Your protagonist is a true crime writer named Gage Chandler. One day his editor emails him a news clipping. Can you tell us about that news clipping?
The clipping, it's a very small incidental notice. It's actually it'd be a photostat of some microfiche. He says that somebody was going through something for another project and ran across a story about a crime scene where there'd been a couple of bodies and what appeared to be some satanic or cultic decorations on the scene inside a porn store in Milpitas, California. So he sends this to his writer and says, hey, this looks like this building is up for sale. I looked into it. This looks like your thing, because he has this method acting way of writing where he gets inside a property.
I was really intrigued by your writing style in the early part of the book where you're describing the history of the Devil House. You convey this really strong, really powerful sense of place. Why did you devote so much cognitive bandwidth to this part of the novel?
I sort of feel like, every place is so distinctive that you don't really know anything about it unless you've been there. I sort of always felt this way, and then the feeling became much stronger after I lived in Iowa for 7 or 8 years. And you hear people talk about Iowa, and you say, wow, you don't know anything about what it's like here. You've seen Field of Dreams, and that's about it. Or you watch the caucuses every 4 years, and then they do some local color interviews. And it sort of shored up in me that if you're trying to sketch a picture of a place, you should give as complete a feeling of it as you can. And I think that starts with history. Like, how did this place come to be populated by immigrants? Almost always, if you're talking about the U.S., right? Most, if you're not native to the country, then your people immigrated at some point. And how did they get there? And California, there's a general story of the westward movement, but every place in California has its own version of that, has its own story. And in the case of places outside of San Francisco, these are post-gold rush places that then become industrial centers, and in the case of Milpitas, become tech centers, right? And so I was interested in that. I sort of think it helps bring people inside a place, because these stories are relatable once you dig deep enough into them.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that helps in the case of Devil House is that it's had these different lives. Like, it started out as a diner, then it becomes a newsstand, then it ends up as a porn store and a video store.
I think every building has a story like that, if it's got any age at all, right? I think this is something I've been thinking about since I was a kid. You know, when you're a child, if you, at some point, you think, wow, somebody lived here before we did. It's a very profound moment, you know, when you're a kid. And I moved to the South from the West Coast, where a lot of places are only, you know, 100 years old or less, where I grew up. But out here, like, there's buildings that are still having new lives 150, 200 years down the line. You know, that's pretty interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. What was it about the Satanic Panic of the 1980s that made you want to include it in the book?
For one thing, I worked in mental health late 80s, most of the 90s, and the early 2000s. I was working in mental health, and I was there. I was at ground level for the Satanic Panic, working on children's and adolescents' units. So I had these adolescent characters who I was going to have marking the porn store in some way to scare off people, well, not to scare them off, but to freak out people who happened across it. And that sort of seemed like an obvious route in. The devil as a trope, I'm hardly the first writer to be kind of drawn to that, right? So it's like, I have some esoteric ideas. I'm into Christianity, but the devil is John Milton. The devil is a very post-medieval notion, or at least medieval. And so I like to think about sort of the power it has totemically, these ideas of radical, outreaching evil. And also it has to do with, all that ties into the fact that folklore and urban legend play into a lot of the themes in this, the things people think they know about things. The Satanic Panic was a case where a lot of people thought they knew a lot about stuff they didn't actually know about.
You have a section in the book that explores Gage's previous book. It's told in the second person. Can you tell us about it?
This is Gage Chandler's first book, the one that they made a movie out of, so he got a little action off that. Gage talks in part one about, if you're going to write in a genre that's kind of crowded, you want to be able to distinguish yourself in some way. And stylistically, he's got a little something different going, right? He writes in the second person, which has a pretty interesting effect. So yeah, it's a story that takes place in Morro Bay, which was a town near San Luis Obispo where I was a kid. This central California area, it really looks like the Mediterranean. It's gorgeous. And it's a story of self-defense, which is what Castle Doctrine is purportedly all about, right? It's like that you should be able to defend your home against invaders, right? Now, again, this is a legal precept that is often deployed in some pretty nefarious circumstances. But in the case of the White Witch, she gets life, or the chair. I can't remember. I do remember researching this and going, wait, it's California, and they outlawed capital punishment in California after Carol Chessman, who was 69, so she can't get the chair, right? I remember doing that research. So that's what it's about. It's about a school teacher who defends herself against a couple of invaders.
Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful parts of Devil House is when Jana Perez, the mother of one of Diana Crane's victims, writes a letter to Gage. Can you tell us about this letter?
Structurally, I was looking for a solution to the fact that I wanted this book to have this mirror structure. So parts 1 and 7 are in the first person, parts 2 and 6 are in the second person, parts 3 and 5 are in the third, and then the fourth part is discrete. It's its own thing and stands alone. But when I got to part 5, I didn't want to just really continue the book we'd already been looking at in part 2. So I thought, how else could we write in the second person? And that's when I got the idea of addressing. It's still narrated by Gage, but he's describing the letter he was sent and responding and saying, you said this to me. But it's by the mother of one of Diana Crane's victims. You usually don't call the victims of a self-defense killing victims, but that's who they are to their mothers and fathers. So that's what it is. It's an attempt to broaden the scope of the telling of a story, because when we tell a story where somebody gets seriously hurt or killed, in really any story, questions of perspective loom, and we usually, almost every story winds up being narrowed to only include one perspective, with maybe a nod toward the possibility of other perspectives. But I wanted to burrow a little deeper and see if we could understand how stories like these affect sort of the incidental people in their tellings.
Yeah, and Jenna is really mad at Gage for what he wrote about her son. To me, this raises a lot of questions about the ethics of writing true crime. Do you think true crime writers are exploiting victims for their own gain?
Well, I mean, yes. At the same time, that's not to say people shouldn't write these books. I'm more looking at, I mean, it's a broader question than just true crime. That's the specific case of what I'm talking about. But I think all writing, even fiction writing, is to some extent open to charges of having left out important perspectives. But that sounds pretty sterile to say it that way. I mean, who cares? You left out some perspectives, right? So, but if you look at it in a specific case, if someone's saying, look, this harmed me, this made something bad worse for me, then that fairly sterile point about writing becomes vivid. So it's the case in true crime, it's the case in biography, it's the case in autobiography, and, you know, it's the case in the news, that when you tell a story, you are only including some of the perspective, most likely. And of course, there's no cure for that. You can't sort of both sides something until you have no story. That's impossible, right? But at the same time, if anything, it's a call for care, for taking care and being aware, for reading one's own work and seeing what you maybe didn't notice you were saying, and so forth. And it's important in true crime. But I do want to say, the book is not so much a critique of true crime as more about the weight of writing, of its specific weight on real people out in the world.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Very well said, yes. Besides your career as a novelist, you also have a career as the main member of the Mountain Goats. So I'm curious, how do your novels influence your songwriting, and how does your songwriting influence your novels?
I don't know that they do. I think anything I write, anything anybody writes, comes from a sort of a river inside, or an electrical current, like a broad picture, not a thin current, but a broad stream of current, you know. And it can assume various forms, but the actual impulse is more raw than that. It doesn't have words, it doesn't have melody, it's a mood. Picking a form for it is almost arbitrary. You know, I think I do tend to look at bigger, more open-ended questions in books, mm-hmm. and in songs. In songs, you're looking for the way the melody can wrap around the words in a way that makes them maximally effective. You know, you don't have the leisure that you have in a novel. So while they are part of a creative continuum, I'm not sort of like borrowing things from one realm to put into the other. They're discrete in that way.
Mm-hmm. But correct me if I'm wrong on this, John, but also a lot of your songs are kind of story-based and feature characters. So does a character that ever starts in a song, they
yes.
always stay in a song, they don't make it to a novel?
No. There's a bunch of reasons I wouldn't do that. I mean, for one thing, with characters in books, you really have to, part of the point is to make them very vivid. So you are
right.
telling the reader what they are supposed to see. Now, there's a lot of play you can do with that, right? You can tell the reader what they're supposed to see and then yank the rug out from under them later, right? When something new is revealed, right? But with characters in songs, they're sketches. So even when you have a lot of good detail, a character in a song is somebody that the reader or listener is going to bring more of themselves to, right? They are very different in that way. That a character in a book, you are trying to put as much meat on their bones as you can, right? You're trying to show somebody, and Dickens is sort of like the master of this, right? That like when Dickens paints a character, then we all see the same thing. You know, we really get a feel for Martin Chuzzlewit or whoever, you know. But in songs, you find that people all have their own feeling for a character. Maybe a broad subsection of one's audience can bring their own idea to some character and say, look, this is who this person is for us. But music has a subjectivity. I mean, all literature has a subjectivity to it, but the subjectivity of songs is almost radical, that the whole idea of a song is to sound specific, so it doesn't sound like I'm just sort of like saying any old thing and letting you fill in the blanks. But I am saying something loose enough that you can bring your own experience to it and thread the two together. I think in that sense, music is a much more communal and collaborative effort than books are. Reading a book is still a very active process, but the writer has a much bigger job in writing a book in terms of laying out the parameters of what the reader is going to see and feel and hear.
Very well said. John Darnielle, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Devil House and, of course, your work with the Mountain Goats.
Thank you so much. Good to hear from you.
John Darnielle is the author of the novel Devil House and the singer-songwriter of the Mountain Goats. You can find out more about John at wpr.org/beta.
we are kind of defiantly Asian American in some cases, certainly resiliently Asian American. But most importantly, we no longer feel quite the same need to explain ourselves.
Coming up, Jeff Yang talks about his new book, Rise, which delivers a comprehensive history of Asian Americans through the lens of popular culture. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.